Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've been looking at this extensive source material on a framework for self-regulation called the Mind Matrix Model, or MMM.
That's right. It's a pretty ambitious framework.
It really is. Yeah. It claims to be a kind of shortcut to navigating stress and healing some of those, you know, deeply embedded survival responses.
And it introduces a lot of new concepts. You have the three selves, you have state, scripts, sentries. It's a whole system for mapping your internal world.
Which brings us right to our mission for this deep dive. Mm. When you see a big comprehensive model like this, the very first question has to be, how credible is it?
Right. Is this just some clever philosophy, or is it actually grounded in something real?
Exactly. Is it grounded in established science and, you know, real human experience? We need to find those anchors.
And that grounding is so important because of what the model is aiming for. It isn't promising, say, guaranteed happiness. That's always fleeting.
It's circumstantial.
It is. The goal here is something deeper, what's called equanimity.
Which is what exactly?
It's that ability to maintain your calmness, your composure, your center, even when things are incredibly difficult.
I really like that distinction because happiness feels conditional, but equanimity, that sounds more like a foundational resilience, something that isn't so easily knocked over.
Precisely. You know, it reminds me of that old Taoist story, the one about the farmer.
Oh, right.
His luck is always changing. He loses a horse and people say bad luck. Then the horse comes back with wild horses, good luck. Then his son breaks his leg, bad luck.
And to every single thing he just says, maybe.
Maybe.
That radical acceptance, that's the inner peace the model is trying to help you cultivate.
That's the idea. But the question is, how does a map, a framework, help a modern person get to maybe when we're all dealing with, you know, financial stress, social media, all of it?
It seems almost impossible sometimes.
Well, that's where the map comes in. It doesn't tell you to ignore reality. It gives you a way to understand how your system is reacting so you can start to choose your response.
Okay, so let's start there. Let's manage expectations for everyone listening. Because if you're looking for a peer-reviewed paper called The Mind Matrix, you're not going to find it.
No, you're not.
So what is this model actually claiming to be?
We have to be really careful here. It's not a diagnosis system. It's not a replacement for therapy or other modalities.
Okay.
The best way to think of it is as a useful map, an integrative framework. And it's built on, well, two main pillars.
Go on.
First, converging evidence from fields we already know and trust. Neuroscience, psychology, and even some of those ancient wisdom traditions. And the second pillar is just clinical pragmatics.
Which is a fancy way of saying?
What actually works to help people feel better in the real world.
So its credibility comes from how well it pulls all these different threads together, how it synthesizes things we already kind of know.
Exactly. The value isn't in memorizing the new words like sentry or monarch. The value is using the map to know instantly where you are inside your own system.
Am I in survival mode right now? Am I in social connection mode?
Right. Or am I in that reflective planning mode? It's all about giving you choice, compassion, and clarity.
And that means for our language here, we need to be careful too. We should be using phrases like consistent with or aligned with science.
Not proven by or validated. It connects the dots. It doesn't claim to have invented the dots.
Okay, so let's dig into that first pillar, neuroscience. The model talks a lot about state and the three selves. How does that line up with how we now understand the brain?
Well, the modern view of the brain is that it's all about networks. It's not a bunch of isolated little modules doing one job each.
Right.
Functions like managing stress or making a plan, those things emerge from coordinated systems. And those systems shift and change based on what's needed. The model calls that your state.
So the three selves, vital, heart, and head, they're not physical spots in your brain. They're more like three different modes of operating.
Precisely. And that shifting between modes is backed up by real physiology. Think about the big shift the model describes between the positive balanced state and the negative reactive state. That's totally consistent with your autonomic nervous system, the ANS. That's the constant dance between your sympathetic system, your go mode, fight or flight.
And your parasympathetic system.
Right, your rest and digest, your calm mode. It's a real physical process.
The material also brings up this second brain in the gut, the enteric nervous system.
Yeah.
Why is that so important here, especially for the vital self?
Because your state isn't just in your head. Your gut is a huge source of what's called interoception, The vital self is really aligned with that, with arousal and interoception.
That's your awareness of your internal bodily state, right?
Yeah.
Like butterflies in your stomach or your face getting hot.
Yes, exactly. It's the physical feeling before your brain has even labeled it anxiety or anger. The vital self is anchored in that basic survival-oriented regulation. It has to be stable first.
Okay, so if the vital self handles physical survival like fight or flight, what about the heart self? I mean, isn't social rejection also a kind of survival threat?
That is an excellent question. And yes, it is. The difference is the orientation. The vital self is asking, can I live through this? It's self-focused.
And the heart self.
The heart self is asking, do I belong? Am I safe with these people? It's all about relational survival. It's processing all those subtle cues of acceptance or rejection that, for a tribal species like us, we're literally life or death.
And that leaves the head self.
Which is aligned with meaning-making, building models of the world, planning, your story about who you are, all that good analytic and holistic thinking.
But the key seems to be that your conscious awareness, what the model calls the monarch, can only really use the head self effectively when your state is balanced.
That's the core insight. Let's talk about that negative state. When stress just builds and builds without release, the system gets stuck in this threat-dominant operating condition.
And what happens then?
Critically, your higher-order functions get constrained. Your prefrontal cortex, the part that does complex planning, manages impulses, sees other perspectives.
The rational part of your brain.
Yes. It gets significantly reduced. The system isn't trained to reflect anymore. It's trained to react instantly. And that's the mode idea. You don't become a bad person in a negative state. Your system just shifts into a much less flexible, threat-focused mode.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's move from the how we react, the physiology, to the why, the psychology. This is where the model is acting as a translation layer.
Yes, it pulls together some really powerful insights from therapy without all the jargon. A great example is its connection to attachment and developmental psychology.
How so?
The source material is clear that your earliest environment, how you were held, soothed, responded to, that literally teaches your three selves how to operate. It sets the rules for how you engage with the world.
And this is where that idea of internalizing pain comes from. The model says a child in a difficult situation will often believe it's their job to fix it, which can lead to these adult patterns of shame and guilt.
Exactly. And that aligns so well with clinical concepts. You see defensive strategies emerge, like minimizing your own needs, which some call echoism, or on the other end, inflating your self-worth. Both are just ways a very zealous heart sentry is trying to protect a fragile core.
It reframes them as protection, not flaws.
Which is so much more compassionate. The model also really leans into trauma-informed therapy principles. That core motto, regulate first, reflect second, heal steadily.
It's a bottom-up approach. You have to calm the body, the vital self, first.
If you don't, reflection just becomes rumination. It can actually make the negative state worse. This is why the sources talk about titration.
Titration. So that's about gently processing intense things. Can you give us a real-world example?
Sure. Imagine you're journaling about a really painful memory. Instead of forcing yourself to write out the whole story at once, which might just overwhelm your system.
You'd flood yourself.
Right. Titration is writing maybe one or two sentences. Then you pause. You take a deep breath, you notice the feeling in your body, and you only go back to writing when you feel stable again. You're dipping a toe in the water, not diving in head first.
That makes it feel so much more manageable. What about cognitive and behavioral traditions? The models, scripts, and sentries?
Well, this is perfectly consistent with the idea of updating your beliefs and habits. A sentry say, the habit of overthinking or catastrophizing is a pattern, not a prophecy.
It gives you a choice point.
It does. But again, the model rightly says that you can only do that cognitive work reliably when your nervous system is in a balanced state. You can't reason with a tiger when your vital self thinks there's one in the room.
So the MMM gives you a roadmap for where to intervene. If it's a bodily restless energy, you need a somatic tool for the vital self.
If it's chronic guilt, that's heart self relational work.
And if it's that nagging self-critical voice, that's head self metacognitive work. It helps you match the tool to the problem.
It moves you past that one-size-fits-all approach. And this leads to that third pillar of credibility, ancient wisdom.
Now, this part could sound a bit mystical.
It could, but it's really about pattern recognition. Think of it as parallel discovery. For thousands of years, different cultures, without any fMRIs, used deep experience to map the human mind. And they kept coming up with similar structures.
What are those recurring patterns? What do they all seem to find?
Almost all of them have a distinction for body and energy regulation. That's the vital self. They have a distinction for the heart, emotion, relationships, the heart self, and for the mind thought, meaning the head self.
And the most important part.
And crucially, almost all of them identify some kind of witness or awareness capacity, the part that can observe all the rest without judgment. That's what the MMM calls the monarch.
The fact that you see that impartial observer pop up in so many different traditions, that feels significant. It suggests it's a core part of being human.
It really does. I mean, think of the yin-yang symbol. It's not good versus evil. It's about dynamic balance, constant interchange. Contemplative practices are just the tools they develop to strengthen that monarch, to make it an active choice maker.
So the convergence across time and cultures, it adds this layer of, well, not proof, but deep resonance.
It's a strong anchor, which brings us to maybe the model's most powerful feature, the metaphor itself, the kingdom of the mind.
Right. Why use this imagery of a monarch, ministers, scripts, and sentries?
Because a good metaphor is a usability bridge. It's the difference between a dense engineering manual and a simple, clear diagram. It makes these abstract neurological and psychological systems feel real, memorable, and actionable.
The roles are very intuitive. The monarch is your conscious self, the voice of reflection and choice.
Yeah, think of the monarch as the CEO who finally gets the audit report on the different departments, the ministers, which are the vital heart and head selves, and sees which ones are overworked or inefficient.
Let's talk about the sentries, though.
Yeah.
Because I could see someone thinking, okay, the sentries are the bad guys. I have to fight them.
That's a really important point. And the model is careful here. Sentries aren't villains. They are more like castle guards who are still on high alert for a war that ended years ago.
Like a childhood fear of abandonment or something.
Exactly. Their intent is protective, but their methods are outdated and often painful. That head sentry voice that says, you always mess things up, it speaks as if it's you. But it's really a mechanism designed to protect you from the pain of future failure.
So the metaphor's power is that it shifts you from self-judgment, I'm a failure, to pattern recognition. That's my head sentry trying to protect me.
That changes everything.
So we've covered the grounding. Let's make this super practical. What actually changes when you start using this framework? What are the tangible outcomes?
The first, and maybe the biggest, is less shame. You start to see that a reactive pattern, whether it's snapping at someone or withdrawing completely, is a sentry or a mode. It's not a fundamental character defect.
You can just say, this is a mode, not who I am.
And that's incredibly freeing. The second is better sequencing, that mantra. Regulate first, then reflect.
We've all been in that reactive pinball machine, right? Yelling about a sock on the floor when you're actually upset about an email from your boss.
Of course. The model teaches you to use a fast override, a vital self tool like box breathing or acupressure, to calm your state before you try to solve the sock problem.
Which leads to better targeting. Instead of just feeling a big mess of overwhelmed, you can ask,
which self is driving this? And that precision is key. Doom scrolling is often a head self script. Anxiety about a party is a heart self sentry. When you know the source, you can pick the right tool.
And finally, there's better repair.
This is where the monarch becomes a reflective catalyst. You use tools like journaling, not just to vent, but to identify the sentry's script like, I always freeze under pressure. And then from a balanced state, you start to counter it with actual evidence of your own resilience. You actively update the old programming.
So to pull it all together, the Mind Matrix model is this coherent, usable map.
It is. It's grounded in the neuroscience of state and networks, the psychology of development and change, and the enduring wisdom of traditions describing balance and awareness. It just puts it all together in one place.
And that cohesion brings us to a final thought for you to consider, something called the middleman illusion.
The middleman illusion is that trap we all fall into, of believing that peace or wholeness depends on some external thing, a better job, a perfect relationship, more money in the bank.
We think those things are the direct cause of peace.
They're the middleman. The provocative insight here is about focus. We spend so much energy trying to avoid the ditch on the side of the road. We fixate on what we fear, the lack of money, the potential failure.
But the monarch's direction is like a steering wheel.
It is. And if you stare only at the ditch you're trying to avoid, you will inadvertently steer yourself right into it, into that chronic negative state activation.
So the goal isn't to pretend the ditch doesn't exist.
No. The goal is for the monarch to consciously choose the magnet, to shift your internal focus from the fear you're running from to the resilience and integration you're building toward.
The measure of success isn't some state of permanent perfection. It's integration. The monarch listens, adjusts, and brings the whole system together. And as the model says over and over, that journey starts wherever you are right now.